I will present you our latest work with Dario and Razvan about this line of fixed points in a bosonic tensor model. So first I will present you the motivation behind random tensors. So first of all, as you know, in quantum field theories, a lot of the objects are defined quite formally and have many divergences. So one of the way to solve this is to accept that physics change with the energy scale. So this is the idea behind the renormalization group. So you have a fundamental theory in the ultraviolet, and then you choose an infrared scale, and you obtain an effective theory in the infrared. And so it is in this setting, your theory is just a point in an infinite dimensional space. And so then when you change your energy scale, this theory will flow from the UV to the IR. So this idea can be dated back to Wilson. It has been formulated in a more modern way as a flow in the space of theory by Polchinski. So once you have this flow, you can look at fixed points, so the theories that do not depend on the scale, and the trajectories between those fixed points. Then another motivation comes from two related problems. So the first is the problem of the quantum gravity frontier. So how to define quantum geometry, and in the renormalization group setting, you have your IR and UV scale, how to do it near the Planck scale. Another problem with QFTs is the weak versus strong coupling. In a setting with a weak coupling, you have a small parameter and you can expand perturbatively around it, do perturbation theory. But if you have a strong coupling, we don't know well how to do it, how to solve the theory in a strong coupling regime. Moreover, those two problems are related by holography, yeah, the ADS-CFT correspondence. So now, how does tensors fit in all of this? How can they help solve this problem? So random tensors are a generalization of matrix models that are related to quantum gravity in two dimensions. So they were first introduced in this context of random geometry and quantum gravity, but in dimension greater than two. So they were introduced in relation with this first problem. But recently, there has been application of random tensors to strongly coupled QFTs and holography. Because in tensor models, you have an extra parameter, n, the size of the tensor. And so you can look at the large n limit. You now have a small parameter, 1 over n, around which you can do a perturbative expansion. But it would be non-perturbatively in the coupling constant, so that you can access the strongly coupled regime. This large n limit is also interesting because it's a non-trivial family called Mellonic diagrams. So it's obtained from a prime Mellon with just two vertices and parallel edges. And then you obtain recursively the whole family of graphs by replacing the edge by this bilocal term. And so you obtain the whole family, more and more complicated graphs. So this is the leading order graphs in the tensor models and in quantum field model in strongly coupled regimes, such as the SYK model. But now you can say there is also other models with large n limits. So why is the tensor one interesting? So first, you can start with vectors with one index. And the large n limit will be dominated by cactus or bubble diagrams. It's just local insertion of this pattern. But this family is quite easy. It's not very rich, so it's not so useful to describe a lot of different models. But then you can go to matrices. Now you have two indices. But the large end limit is dominated by planar diagrams. So this is a huge family that we don't know how to resum or how to count. So it's a very hard problem. But the surprise was that when we go to a tensor, even if the combinatorics is more complicated, we have more indices. As I just showed you, the large end limit is dominated by these Mellon diagrams. So it's a subfamily of planar diagrams, but it's more tractable. In many cases, we know how to resum them. So it's both richer than the vector case and simpler to compute than the matrices. Then we have quite a lot of different types of tensor models that can have this limit. So first, people try to study random tensors with fully symmetric tensors, but they couldn't find a suitable large n limit with a non-trivial family of graph. But it was shown that the first type of model that was shown to have this Mellonic limit were colored tensor models. So you have four tensor fields that are distinguished by this upper index I. And then you have an On to the sixth symmetry, meaning that each indices of the tensor is distinguished by its position. Then you have a slightly simpler model, uncolored one. Now you have only one tensor field, but the indices are still distinguished by their position, so it's On to the cube symmetry. And recently it was also proven that some models with symmetries could have a Mellonic large n limit, so it's one tensor field and On symmetry. But in order to achieve that, you need to have an irreducible representation of the symmetry group. So, for example, it works for symmetric traceless tensors or antisymmetric ones. Then you have also completely different types of models that admit this large n limit. So, as I said, you have the SYK model. So, it's a quantum mechanical model of Majorana fermions with tensorial coupling constant. And you have also multi-matrix models, for example, or models even in higher rank than three, etc. So here in the following, we will study an uncolored tensor model. So that was for the combinatorics of the tensors, but we can also look at the field aspect. Because first they were introduced in zero dimensions, so it was not a quantum field theory. It was only to study random geometry. But then it was shown by Witten that in one dimension, it can be related to this SYK model, but without disorder. Because the problem in the SYK model was that you had a quenched disorder. But with the tensor, you can get rid of this disorder and have a truly quantum mechanical model. And then when you go in even higher dimension, it has been shown that these tensor models will give rise to a new family of conformal field theories. But there are problems. Because in this new type of CFTs, we have divergences in the computation of the two-point functions and of the dimensions of the operators. So for fermionic tensor models, that can be cured with anti-commutation, but we don't have such mechanism with bosonic tensor model. So we had the idea to use the renormalization group, and we found non-trivial fixed points and even the existence of an infrared attractive fixed point. So now I'm going to present you the model we studied, and then the renormalization for the two-point function and for the four-point couplings and their beta function. And finally, I will sketch the computation of the dimensions of operators. So we studied a real tensor field, so bosonic, of rank 3 and size n. And we considered On to the cube symmetry. So this means that each index will transform independently under On symmetry. So we have three independent orthogonal matrices. And then we can write an action. So it's called the CTKT action because it was introduced by Sylvain and Adrien Tanaza in zero dimension and then generalized in D dimension by Klebanov and Tarnopolsky. So we have first a kinetic term, and we will allow a non-trivial power of the Laplacian. And we come back to that later. And we have a mass term, and we have a three different quartic interaction. So these three different quartic interaction correspond to On to the cube invariance, and it corresponds to different patterns of contraction between the indices of the tensors. So to look at this interaction invariance, it's easier to do a graphical representation. So we represent each tensor by a vertex and the contraction of two indices by an edge with a color that corresponds to the position of the index. So here I represented the first index by the color red, the second green, and the third blue. Then, for example, the tetrahedron invariance would be a pattern of contraction when each tensor has exactly one index contracted to every other tensors. So if we take this first tensor and we put it here, see that the red edge will correspond to the contraction with this one, and the green with the third one, and the blue here with the last one. So this gives, if you look at it in 3D, a tetrahedron. So that's what it is. Then we have the pillow interaction. Actually, it's three different interactions depending on the color of this vertical edge. And here you have like pairs of tensors that share two indices, and then one propagates with the other pair here. And finally, you have the last interaction term, the double trace, so it's a disconnected interaction, and we have two tensors sharing all three indices. So this representation is called a three-colored graph. So now that we have the interaction vertices, we can look at the expansion of the action into Feynman diagrams. So to do so, as I said, we will have the interaction invariant as three-colored graph. And then we will represent the pairing of tensors with a propagator by an edge of a new color between the vertices. So here, the color black. So these edges. Then if we want to go back to usual Feynman graph, we just have to shrink the interaction vertices to a point, and that would be enough to compute the amplitude integrals. However, if we want to look at the scaling in n for the large n limit, we have to keep the whole structure. Because here you see the edges, the black edges, will represent a contraction between all three indices of the n tensors, whereas the edges of color red, green, or blue will only correspond to the contraction of the first, the second, or the third index. So that will allow us to look at the scaling in n of the diagram to determine the large n limits. So the first thing to notice is that we will get a factor n per phase of color black and red, green, or blue. Because if you see here, for example, this phase green and black, you will have the second index that will propagate. It will be identified with this one, then this one, and back here, so it will be a factor n.
You mean after the contraction?
Yeah, after the contraction, you will end up with a sum of a delta AA, for example, so it's n. And so the amplitude will scale as n to the power of the number of faces, and then some coefficient times the number of tetrahedron, pillow, and double trace vertex. So these numbers came from here, from this choice in the action. It was actually chosen to have a sensible large and limits. And then we can show that this model will have a large and limit dominated by what we called Mellon tadpoles diagrams. So it's a graph constructed by inserting melons with tetrahedral vertices and tadpoles with pillow or double trace vertices. Then you can ask, why do we have tadpoles? Because I told you in the introduction that these tensor models had a Mellonic large N limit. It's in fact because the pillow and double trace contraction patterns are actually radiative correction from the tetrahedron. So you can represent the pillow as a rung with two tetrahedron, and the double trace as a ladder with two rungs of tetrahedron. You see here, for example, the red goes like this, and here also, and the blue and the green propagate like this. So here, and the blue goes down and back up. And again, here, the green and the blue up and back down. So it's the same contraction pattern regarding the indices. So then our model has indeed a Mellonic large N limit, but only after substituting the pillow and double trace vertices by their representation in terms of tetrahedron. For example, if you take this tadpole with the pillow vertex here and you replace it by the rung, you will obtain a melon. Those two edges correspond to the two edges of the rung, and these two correspond to the edges of the original tadpole. Okay. So now that we have our large N limit, we can start looking at the computation of the two-point function and the problem of renormalization. So as I said, we will look at a non-trivial power of the Laplacian, because classically, if you take one, it has been shown that there is a non-trivial conformal infrared limit, and that the scaling in the infrared would be as p to the minus d over 2. However, in this theory with the interaction I presented you, there are divergences in any dimension. So an idea was to make sense of the infrared theory, was to set from the beginning the power of the Laplacian to be d over 4, so that the Baire covariance will reproduce the infrared scaling of the two-point function. So this shows made our interaction power counting marginal, meaning that the power counting of a graph does not depend on the number of internal vertices, but only on the number of external points. So that's all two-point function will have the same divergence, all four-point function will have the same, etc. So this idea was already implemented in the case of the SYK model in one dimension by Gross and Rosenhaus. So for the two-point function, the power counting tells us that the graph are power divergent. So then we decided to use parametric cutoffs, so cutoff on the Schwinger parameters. So the choice, the precise choice of the cutoff should not impact the results. The result should be independent of the choice of the cutoff, but we made this choice to simplify the computation. Then this will allow us to regularize the Schwinger-Dyson equation. So this equation links the full two-point function with the propagator and the self-energy, which is the one particle irreducible part of the two-point function. So you can find this equation by saying that the full two-point function should be a chain of 1 pi vertices linked by propagators. Then what's interesting here is that we have this large N limit, so we know how to express the self-energy only in terms of the full two-point function. So the Schwinger-Dyson equation becomes closed on G, and this is a characteristic feature of tensor models at large N. So here, this form of the self-energy would be a mass term, a melon with tetrahedron vertices, and tadpoles with pillow and double trace vertex. And so you can see, even from here, that we will have this tadpole term that is local, like a mass term. So it will contribute to the renormalization of the mass. And then we have this bilocal term, but in fact, it will contribute both to the renormalization of the mass and then the bilocal term contributing to the wave function. So I will not go into detail, but we showed that it was possible to subtract the divergence in the bare mass so that to tune the renormalized mice to zero. And then we found a finite wave function renormalization that we could express analytically.
Is it necessary to go to the zero mass?
Because we want to have a CFT. So, so we found this finite wave function renormalization. And it's not a coincidence. It's because we chose from the beginning the scaling of the propagator to match the infrared scaling. So we don't have any more anomalous dimension. We managed to find the renormalization for the mass and the wave function. So now what about the four-point couplings? The power counting tells us that they are logarithmically divergent. And we have three different couplings to look at, the tetrahedron, the pillow, and the double threads. So let's start with the tetrahedron coupling. So there is no radiative correction from the four-point leading graph. And we have this finite wave function renormalization. So we showed that the tetrahedral coupling does not run. It's just a rescaling of the bare one by the wave function. Then we can express this wave function thanks to this equation. We can express the wave function in terms of the renormalized coupling and some constants. And so we have a function of the bare one in function of the renormalized one. And then we have two cases. We can have the bare tetrahedral coupling real, and then this function would be invertible only for g smaller than this constant gc, and the wave function will diverge when the tetrahedral coupling, the bare one, goes to infinity. However, here our tetrahedron interaction does not have any positivity property. So we can choose to take the bare and the renormalized coupling purely imaginary. Then this function would be invertible for the modulus of j smaller than this value. And this time, the wave function would be bounded. So then we can go to the pillow and the double trace couplings. This time it's a little bit more complicated because we have a mixing between those two couplings. Because when we contract two pillows, we can obtain either again a pillow or a double trace contraction pattern. So the pillow interaction will contribute to the double trace one. So we decided to parameterize the action in terms of two independent couplings. So one is just the rescaling of the pillow and the other the sum of the double trace and the pillow. And so after that, we could find the leading four-point graph. So we showed that it was a series of connected chain graphs. So it's irreducible pieces linked by parallel horizontal edges. So here, our irreducible pieces are this bubble, or these rungs with tetrahedral vertices, or just a bare vertex with the pillow and double trace. So knowing this expansion, we could find a precise structure for the bare expansion of the couplings and for the beta functions. So now I would just present the results for the beta function. So the beta function is the logarithmic derivative of the renormalized coupling. And it characterizes the flow of the theory, how it changes with the energy scale. So here we found that our beta function were quadratic in the coupling. So this is not a truncated theory, it is an exact expression. And then this coefficient of the beta function or power series in the square of the tetrahedral coupling. We can compute it at first orders, and we can even show that they are a subtraction of a generating function of a family of graph. But this is, I won't go into these complicated details here. So once we have the beta function, we can look at the fixed points. So it's the points where the beta function is zero. It's a point where the theory does not depend on the scale. So here, our beta function admits two fixed points, linear in the tetrahedral coupling. Actually, it's two lines of fixed points parameterized by this coupling. And then we can compute the corresponding critical exponent. This critical exponent will characterize the stability of the fixed point. For example, if it's positive, the fixed point will be stable in the infrared. If it's negative, it would be instable. And then we found also the fixed point and the critical exponent for the second coupling with just rescaling of the tetrahedral one. And so you see, if we send this tetrahedral coupling to zero, then we will find a trivial fixed point, like a Gaussian fixed point. And again, as I told you before, we can choose the tetrahedral coupling to be purely imaginary. And with this choice, you see that both the fixed points and the critical exponent would be real, at least for small g. Then we can look at the properties of this four line of fixed points. So we have the first one, G1 plus G2 plus, that is infrared attractive and stable. And then we have G1 minus G2 minus, that is this time a UV attractive fixed point. And so we have an explicit renormalization group trajectory from the UV fixed point to the infrared fixed point. And this is symmetric around the trivial fixed point. But this trivial fixed point is obtained only when we send the tetrahedral coupling to zero.
Oh, sorry.
Yes?
So is it true that all these quantities are real even if you expand up to g to the third power? Because you're just truncating your beta functions at g squared, right?
No, you don't have anything. That's the point. It's a
non-order. It's a fact.
You mean... here?
Like the beta functions, are they exactly, but the coefficients have an expansion in G, right?
You mean,
yeah.
Here this is exact, but this coefficient, it's an expansion in G, but we proved that it was finite.
Okay, but are they still?
Here you mean, this is still, no, this is, I will come back to this later, but we will find complex that will reappear when this g is big, is not small enough.
Oh.
Yeah, so we go now to the dimensions of the operators. So it is not as rigorous as what we did before, but it was interesting to compare it to the results of Klebanov and Tarnopolsky in their model where they chose zeta equal 1 and not d over 4 like we did. And they also use dimensional regularization. So we want to look at the dimension of primary bilinear operators. So we take a three-point function between two field phi and an operator, a primary operator of dimension h. So this is a three-point function. And we have what we call the Bethe-Salpeter equation. So it tells us that the three-point function first has a free term coming from the disconnected part of the four-point function. It's just like in a free theory. And then if you remember when I showed here, the expansion of four-point graph. If we look only at the tetrahedron, you see that we have ladders that are generated by a kernel. And so if you if you convolute this four-point kernel with the three-point function, you still have a three-point function. So that's what the Bethe-Salpeter equation says. So then, in our case, we can neglect this free term. And you see that if we call the kernel k, we have an equation like v equals kv. So it's a little bit like an eigenfunction equation. So it's telling us that the bilinears are, in fact, eigenfunction of eigenvalue 1 of the kernel. And so this will constrain the conformal dimension h to be solution of this equation, f of h equal 1, with f of h this complicated function. And so then we can solve this equation and find the dimension of the bilinear operators. So we found two types of solution. First, this h 0 plus plus minus linear in G, and then an infinite tower of solution, quadratic in G. So just we found a degeneration of the solution in dimension 2. In d equal 2, we have only the first two solutions. We don't have the infinite tower. And then again, if we take here a real tetrahedral coupling, these first two solutions would be imaginary. And that's the instability they found with the model with zeta equal 1 and the dimensional regularization. So they were working in d equal 4 minus epsilon. And with this positive epsilon, they found imaginary dimension. They could have real dimension with negative epsilon, but then their fixed points would be a UV fixed point and not an IR one. But here we have the possibility to choose to take a purely imaginary tetrahedral coupling, and then all our dimensions are real. And this dimension is in fact the dimension of phi phi at the fixed point. And we can check the coherence of this with the critical exponents we computed, because the critical exponent of the double trace is related to the dimension of phi phi square, actually d plus the dimension of phi phi square. And we can check that this is coherent with the dimension we found. However, we found that with a numerical study, here you see its solution, as we said, it's an expansion is g, it's only for small g. And we found that when the modulus of g become greater than some value, we have complex dimensions that reappear. And what was interesting is that, again, numerically, we found this value to be the same one as the value until which the bare coupling was invertible in terms of the renormalized one. So it would be interesting to understand actually why those two criticality are the same. So to conclude, we studied a bosonic real tensor model. And in the large n limits, we found these four lines of fixed points parameterized by the tetrahedral coupling, which is our free parameter. And when we choose this coupling to be purely imaginary, we showed that these fixed points were in fact real and that one of them was infrared attractive. And moreover, we found real dimensions for the bilinear operators. So what would be the perspective for further work? In a recent paper, Kim, Klebanov-Tarnopolsky, and Zhao conjectured that in such models, if we have an appearance of complex dimensions of operators, this implies a breaking of the conformal invariance. So it could be interesting to check this for our model, as we have the appearance of complex dimension. And it could be also interesting to do a more rigorous computation of the dimension of operators by using the same renormalization group techniques as we use for the two-point function and the beta function. And finally, more generally, it could be interesting to do a more detailed study of this new type of CFT that we can call Mellonic CFT. Thank you.
Thank you for your nice talk. We have plenty of time for questions. So, under renormalization, don't usually higher interaction terms appear? So, should something higher than quartic interaction terms appear? Or did you make the truncation to go back to the original interaction term?
No, in tensor models with this pattern of interaction, tetrahedron, pillow, and double twist, this is closed. When you contract two tetrahedrons together, you cannot obtain anything else than the tetrahedron, the pillow, and the double twist.
And so you mentioned holography before, so this is a very naive question. You mentioned the new type of CFT. Do you have any idea what holographic dual is?
Actually, no. Even for the SYK model that has been studied a lot, people don't know yet well what could be an ADS dual. And for this type of theories, this has not been studied at all yet. This could be a goal.
Any more questions? If that's not the case, let's thank Sabine again, and she will be here until the end of next week. Yeah.